This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Italian government this week announced plans to try and streamline procedures for processing migrants who have arrived in Italy and helping to resolve their status more quickly in a way to make them legal or to speed up their expulsion if they're not accepted in the country.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. We'll have the latest developments on the migrant situation in Italy coming up.
Also, the magnitude of the humanitarian crisis caused by the seven-year insurgency is unfolding as the multinational military offensive continues against Boko Haram militants.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, as the multinational military offensive continues against Boko Haram militants, the magnitude of the humanitarian crisis caused by the seven-year insurgency is unfolding. The UN Refugee Agency says there are vast and urgent humanitarian needs in northeast Nigeria and parts of Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. Liz Ahua is the UNHCR's regional representative. From Dakar, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the scope of the crisis.
With the cooperation of the multinational task force is gaining more ground and recovering space from Boko Haram, we are coming across a situation that is extremely, extremely heart-rending. The populations that have been under Boko Haram, the basic social amenities have been completely destroyed. An assessment that was taken, for instance, indicates that over 400,000 homes in Northeast have been completely destroyed, burned, and broken down. We've seen children, particularly with distended stomachs, showing signs of malnutrition, severe malnutrition. We've seen old people even more distressed because their basic coping mechanisms have been destroyed. It's really a very dire and desperate situation that we've seen out there. Infrastructure such as schools, hospitals have been razed. We've been to Bama, we've been to Banki, and it is the same things of desolation that you see across.
Any idea how many people need humanitarian assistance?
The numbers vary according to the immediate humanitarian assistance that is needed. Over 2 million people are internally displaced in Nigeria. Of these 2 million, we have 800,000 that have been newly liberated and to whom we have access. There is still insecurity, but the agencies have been able to go in, including UNHCR, to carry out some activities and then cut out back into Maiduguri. So 800,000 people are in need of humanitarian assistance from the newly liberated areas. But this, I will underscore it again, that in terms of the population that globally needs help inside Nigeria, it is over 2 million people.
Now, the Boko Haram insurgency, as you know, has spread to neighboring countries in the Lake Chad Basin, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger. Now, I understand you have just returned from Niger. Could you describe the situation there?
Indeed. In Niger, I was in the Giffa area that has suffered recent attacks, where in terms of numbers of people that have been displaced, we're talking of over 280,000 people in a region whose normal population is estimated at 600,000 people. So basically, you're talking of more than one quarter of people who've been displaced multiple times. I spoke to a number of people myself, women. We had a town hall meeting, and basically they had to run for their lives. And as usually is the case, having suffered so long under Boko Haram, they are not physically fit. Luckily, there is some food that has been provided to them, water and all that. So they are managing to reestablish themselves. But physically, very fragile, mentally traumatized, and the children are in a similar situation. So, by and large, a very deplorable situation. We are continuously reassessing the situation because more areas are being liberated. At the moment, what the UN has decided to do with all the partners, including governments, is to scale up our response, provide shelter, provide food, provide protection. In the coming months, as the military campaign continues and more access is provided and more people are liberated, we will have to review the situation.
That's UNHCR Regional Representative Liz Ahua from Dakar. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
When Boko Haram militants in Nigeria posted a video on YouTube last Sunday, the parents of 15-year-old Dorcas Yakub watched as their captive daughter cried out for her freedom. Until that moment, they did not know if she was still alive. For 28 months after the mass abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls in Chibok, the Yakubus had only hope. It was an Abuja reporter that first gave them proof on his laptop computer. VOA's David Arnold has the story.
In 2014, journalist Isaac Abrak was pursuing a big story when he drove to Chibok in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria. This was where Boko Haram gunmen had abducted more than 200 girls from a boarding school. When he knocked on the front door of the home of one of the kidnapped victims, the girl's father shouted, "Go away." There had been many reporters there before him. Slowly, Boulos Yakub and his wife Esther learned to trust the persistent but polite reporter. Over the years, they visited often and became friends. Then, last Sunday, Esther Yakub heard a rumor that her daughter was seen on the last Boko Haram video.
In fact, when the video came out, it was the mother that called me and said, "Isaac, I've heard that there's a video of these girls. Is it true?" I said, "Yes." And I said, "Madam, I'm bringing it back to you."
The Yakubs had resettled in Abuja after the Chibok kidnappings. The drive from Abrak's home to theirs was not a long one.
When I opened my laptop, they were kind of calm and curious. The whole family was there, the father, the mother, the missing girl, her younger sister, her younger brother, and also a third younger sibling. They were all there in one room watching curiously at the video on my laptop. And immediately, the Boko Haram ushered in the girl to speak. The mother, who is by name Esther, dropped down on the mattress lying on the bed and started crying. She was weeping aloud. The father, tears were just coming out of his eyes, running down his cheek. The younger sister crying. The younger brother crying. The sibling too, a boy, was also crying. The whole room, it was a very sorrowful mood. You know, At the point, I felt that I brought these people pain, so I had to put off my camera and start talking to them. "Please, I didn't mean to hurt you." And that was when the father just turned and said, "Isaac, we thank you for showing us this video. We give God the glory that we have seen an evidence that our daughter is alive."
When Abrak first drove to Chibok in 2014, he says he was skeptical of the news of the mass kidnapping.
"I should be able to go and see if this was true. Particularly at that moment in time, there were a lot of doubts, especially in Nigeria here, if those girls were actually taken, because people could not believe that over 200 girls would be taken and disappeared into the thin air."
Abrak says he chose the large farmhouse of Boulos Yakub at random. After a lot of gentle persuasion, the father agreed to talk to him.
So at the end of the day, we understood ourselves, and I went into the house, we sat down for like 4 hours and had a very lengthy interview. So when I got in there, I felt their pain. They looked like my people, and there was this bond that was between us. So anytime things happen, they call me, and I call them. And I always, sometimes when I call them, I try to encourage them that if I have information, when I go to the front line over and I see that the military is making successes, I call them, I tell them that the military is making successes into some bigger forest. Keep on praying, your daughter, the possibility that your daughter would come back, and all of that.
When they lost their daughter, they decided to leave Chibok behind. They decided to move with their other children to Abuja, where they would wait for Dorcas' return.
Dorcas' father is a farmer in Chibok. He sells grains that he gets from the farm. And when he moved back to Abuja here, he sold his grains, some of his farmlands, and bought a small taxi, a small vehicle that he is now a taxi man. He drives a taxi in Abuja.
The Yakubs talked with Abrak about their decision to press the government to trade imprisoned Boko Haram fighters for Dorcas and other girls who had appeared in the video.
"They are very clear about it. They have not seen their daughter. They have not had any evidence that their daughter is alive since about 2 years, 4 months now. And seeing their daughter is alive right now, so they just feel that the government should do what is right. And what is right to them is for the government to hit the Boko Haram's demand and so that they would have their daughter back.
The optimism of the Yakub family has filled Abrak, the journalist, with the same hope.
I commend their resilient nature, and I believe that they will get back their daughter because that is what the mother continues to say. One day she will have her daughter in her arms.
Whether Dorcas and other kidnapped girls ever return home may depend on the government's willingness to negotiate with their captors. But first, they must identify who among the fragmented rebel group actually has the girls from Chibok. David Arnold, VOA, Washington.
Seasonal flooding has inundated cities and farmland in Nigeria again this year, killing at least 16 people. But a new smartphone app is helping local authorities warn residents when a flood is poised to strike. VOA's Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
The Waiting app is free and works on any Android phone. The aim is to give anybody in three flood-prone Nigerian states advanced warning when flooding is expected. Timothy Olalekan Williams is the Africa Director for the International Water Management Institute, which developed the app.
The goal is to provide 4 to 5 day lead time warning on river height to allow government officials and planning agencies and disaster management agencies to take adequate precautions and make preparations for disaster prevention and management.
Two major rivers, the Niger and the Benue, converge in Nigeria before emptying into the Atlantic Ocean. Both have been known to spill over their banks during the annual rainy season. Flooding in 2012 was particularly severe, affecting 7 million people and leaving hundreds dead. Kayode Fagbeme, Deputy Director of Planning, Research, and Forecasting for the National Emergency Management Agency, fears this year could be a repeat of that disaster.
The level of water on River Niger has risen to a level where if there is a continuous rainfall and there is a high velocity of rainfall, we may experience flooding similar to what we experienced in 2012.
The Nigerian Meteorological Agency disseminates information through the news media when flooding is expected. Williams says the Waiting app will help those warnings spread even further.
But for the first time ever, we put into the hands of individual planners or anyone with a smartphone to be able to have this information at his or her fingertips.
The app so far only covers Kogi, Anambra, and Benue states in Nigeria, all of which are near the confluence of the two rivers. Williams says they have not yet had to issue any flood warnings since the app was released earlier this month. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Huhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The magnitude of the humanitarian crisis caused by the seven-year insurgency is unfolding as the multinational military offensive in Nigeria continues against Boko Haram militants. And a new smartphone app is helping authorities warn residents of seasonal flooding in Nigeria. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The Italian government is examining how to streamline procedures for processing migrants and to deport those who don't qualify for asylum. From Rome, reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the Italian government's efforts to cope with the continuous influx of migrants as well as other migrant developments.
The Italian government this week announced plans to try and streamline procedures for processing migrants who have arrived in Italy and helping to resolve their status more quickly in a way to make them legal or to speed up their expulsion if they're not accepted in the country. And there was an interesting case study in the Italian media of a 22-year-old Senegalese man called Gianco, who after 4 years of dealing with the Italian bureaucracy has been granted asylum. asylum. He's had a very difficult journey coming into Italy through Libya, paying people smugglers, arrived in Lampedusa in 2012, and it's taken him all this time. And he says that Europe is his only hope. So now that he's been made legal or accepted in terms of his asylum, he's now struggling to get a work permit, which could take another 6 months, he says, for that to be approved.
And I understand there's another concern on one of Tuscany's popular beaches where VIPs and politicians go. What is going on there?
Well, Capalbio is a very glamorous beach area on the Mediterranean side of Italy, on the west coast of Italy in Tuscany, where many VIPs and politicians go. And there's a bit of a debate going on there about whether to accept migrants in the town. And the mayor says we shouldn't forget our tradition of accepting people, and we shouldn't consider this town just to be the location for VIPs. But it is a very divisive issue. It's about accepting around 50 immigrants into the town who should come in early September. But there has been a letter put together by residents and tourist operators in the town who are saying it's unacceptable and there's no place for the migrants in what is essentially a quaint medieval town and a luxury resort.
Also, I understand there's another situation going on in Florence. Can you tell us about what is happening there with the migrants?
Florence prosecutors have begun an investigation into whether this consortium that has been organising the hosting of migrants at 18 different migrant centres across Italy is actually guilty of some kind of maltreatment. And there were suggestions that this consortium was cramming up to 30 immigrants into a small apartment in the northern city of Genoa. Now, this consortium is making 30 euros a day from the government for every migrant it hosts, and it's taking care of around 380 immigrants. There's concern about potential maltreatment or alleged maltreatment, and the government is under pressure to also monitor these centres and make sure that people are treated fairly and with the right kind of assistance, particularly because the government is making payments to these centres.
And I understand, Josephine, that a Tunisian terror suspect has been deported from Italy. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, Italian authorities on Friday deported an alleged Tunisian terror suspect by the name of Bilal Shoawi from the city of Turin. Investigators said the man had shown ideological support for jihadist extremism and the Islamic State, and was also linked to other Tunisian foreign fighters who had died in the Iraq or Syrian conflicts. Now, Italy has detained around 45 terror suspects this year, and it stepped up security in the wake of the terror attacks that we saw in France and Belgium and Germany recently. But this week there has been a very lively debate about whether terror suspects are using that migrant route from Libya, from Tunisia, across the Mediterranean to arrive in Italy and smuggle potential terrorists into Europe. And this is a debate that we're going to see, I think, in the coming weeks continuing.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Burundi's government is promising to investigate allegations of human rights violations made in a recent United Nations report. Moses Habyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
The UN Committee Against Torture conducted a special review on Burundi last month. It reported an increase in human rights violations in the country, with mostly opposition members being targeted by the Burundi government, security forces, and the ruling party supporters. Burundi's Minister of Human Rights, Martin Nivyabandi, said that the government will investigate and bring perpetrators to justice.
We cannot refuse that there are cases of human rights violation. But it's the same in different countries. This human rights violation, even in Burundi, are facing such challenges, and we have to address them collectively as a human community. And the government of Burundi is committed to do so and to move forward in consolidating peace and security.
More than 400 people have been killed, and hundreds of thousands have fled the country since April of last year after the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office. His critics said it was unconstitutional. Targeted killings and disappearances continue to rock the country. Last month, a local journalist, Jean Bigirimana, went missing in Moravia, a few kilometers from Burundi's capital. Reporters Without Borders said they had received information that the Burundi intelligence service had illegally detained the journalist.
There are some groups who are illegally arresting people. They torture them, claiming that they are saving the National Intelligence Agency of Burundi. It is not true. The strategy of Dominique Street to address these challenges is to collaborate with different institutions involved in human rights promotion, and the results are evident. We have a directorate in charge of human rights and judicial assistance. And we realize that the people came and we supported them.
Two dead bodies were recently pulled from a river near where the local newspaper said its journalist was detained. The paper called on the government to investigate and identify the bodies. National Human Rights Chairman Jean-Baptiste Baribonekeza said that his commission had searched all prisons in Moravia, but still could not find the missing journalist.
The commission was informed actually 3 days after the journalist has disappeared, and we learned this information through the media. We want to inform, therefore, that the current state of affairs, the commission cannot locate the whereabouts of that journalist. And we therefore are very much concerned about the situation of that journalist and what happened on the 22nd of July.
Burundi is more stable compared to last year. However, Amnesty International said that the United Nations Committee Against Torture findings must be a wake-up call for the country. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
For the first time since a deadly cholera epidemic broke out in Haiti in 2010, the United Nations has admitted that its peacekeeping troops played a significant role in the spread of the disease. The epidemic killed nearly 10,000 people in Haiti and infected hundreds of thousands of others. A spokesman for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the United Nations needs to do much more to address the cholera epidemic in Haiti. He promised a significant new set of UN actions to respond to the crisis, probably in 2 months or less. Haitians tried to sue the United Nations for its part in creating the epidemic, but the UN has claimed diplomatic immunity. Late yesterday, a U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the UN's position.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there.
VOA.
On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information. Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. right here on VOA.